We're in our Proverbs series, which I've been enjoying, delighting in. I have missed a couple, so I'm just hoping I'm not repeating, but what the heck. So in the series intro, Emily described Proverbs as folk wisdom, the sayings of the wise culled by the generations until only, you know, the best, the field-tested, the time-tested ones survive. The people's wisdom really can be a form of expertise. For ages, doctors, medical community saw alcoholism as a lack of self-willpower. You know, like all the treatments were like beef up your willpower. And a group of recovering alcoholics together was sharing their experience, figured out together, actually alcoholism is the opposite. It's self-will run riot. And then they created a path of healing that was littered with proverbs. Easy does it. Let go, let God, progress, not perfection. All those things brought healing. So I did not grow up with the book of Proverbs. I didn't grow up with the Bible. I grew up Episcopalian. but something drove me to the Proverbs early in my life. And here's a bit of the backstory, maybe more than you're interested in. My late wife's younger sister, Denise, died recently. My late wife's name is Nancy. Her sister, Denise, died, and I'm talking with her husband, Kit. This is like a couple of months ago, and we're remembering old times together. Like me seeing Kit for the very first time, Nancy's on my lap in the kitchen. I was quite the player in my youth. We were both newly graduated from Henry Ford High School that January, the baby boom, you know, Kit came in and he had long hair. He had a brown leather jacket with tassels, long tassels, and he had a six-pack under that jacket because Nancy's parents were away for the weekend. 54 years later, while I'm talking to him, he's telling me, "Ken, that was March 6, 1970. Denise and I had sex for the first time the day before." I'm like, oh. Thanks for sharing, Kit. He has a prodigious memory. Well, some things you don't forget, but anyway. Kit reminds me that 2 months after that, so that would be May 1970, Nancy had informed her younger sister, Denise, that she, Nancy, is pregnant. And that we were about to announce it to her father, Stan. And so Kit told me, and I'd never heard this before, that he and Denise were circling in their car outside of the house to like watch the drama, and they found a parking spot where they couldn't be seen. And he said, "I saw the moment when you gave the news. I saw Stan's head drop when he found out, you know, he was going to have an 18-year-old son-in-law and a grandchild." Stan's first words to me when he lifted up his head, "You fiddle farted around." I dropped my head, and when I lifted it, I said, "Yes, sir, we did." What else are you going to say? So back to 224, I say to Kit, "You know, we've talked so much over the years. We've had a long, close, you know, friendship, brother-in-laws and all that, so things together. We've talked so much over the years, and we were just having a good time talking then, but I don't remember talking to you much like in that era." He was a year or two behind us in school. Kit said, "Ken, you were like the verbal guy. You had quite the sharp tongue at that time, so I stayed out of your way." I'm like, oh. My pastor part was like, oh. Then my younger self came into sharper focus. I got my sharp tongue from my father. So now it's July 1970. It's a couple of weeks after my wedding. I'm working at Abner Wolf Warehouse on Plymouth Road in Detroit. I had to, before going to school, coming up to school in August, I had to cut open a case of Land O'Lakes butter, and I sliced my knee open with the box cutter, like, shh, you know. my boss has to call my dad, who's my emergency contact, to say that he's taking me to the ER to get me stitched up. And my dad did not miss a beat. He said to my boss, "Too low, too late." Honestly, at the time, I admired him for the wit and the, just to come up with that, you know. Wow. You know who doesn't always appreciate a sharp wit? It's those who live with it, you know. So, which I quickly learned from my wife, Nancy, in the first year of marriage when I would drop some quick wit her way. And thankfully, that's the same time when the Proverbs came into my life. So many Proverbs, as you know, I think this was a focus earlier, stressed the power of words to wreak havoc. Life and death are in the power of the tongue. That's the well-known one. It's also quoted by James. The Haitian immigrants, right, in Springfield, Ohio, are not quoting, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me." That's not in the book of Proverbs. They know better. They know rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. So that there are also withering proverbs for those who know better yet persist in those words. So Proverbs is a form of divine wisdom, but it comes to us in the shape of our humanity, and that's really the key. The Proverbs are not based on some abstract ideal of moral perfection. That's like the currency of Greek philosophy and the modern fundamentalism that has much of the church in a chokehold today. Many Christians, for example, emphasize the authority of Scripture. Like that's the only theory of Scripture, is like the authority of Scripture, the rule of Scripture. In this view, like, Scripture is over us and it's imposing its will on us. But writings can't impose anything, right? Only people who read the writings can impose what they think the writings are saying. So I think this preoccupation with the authority of Scripture, unfortunately, is often a cover for those who crave certainty, claim to have found it, and seek to impose their certainties on others. It's like I said, there's very little like theory of Scripture in the Bible itself, but we do have one very telling remark in 2 Peter 3:16. All Scripture is inspired. Inspired is different. That's a different metaphor than authority. All Scripture is inspired by God and is useful for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, all the things that the Proverbs do, actually, interestingly. So the spire of inspire is from the Latin root for breathe. Inspire is just breathe in. So who and what in Scripture are God-breathed besides Scripture? The Bible opens, of course, with those two famous origin stories, Genesis 1, God breathing over the welter and waste to form matter and life in all its multiple forms. Creation and its living creatures are all in that picture, like God breathed. All of this is God breathed. Then we have Genesis 2, another origin story. The Lord is kneeling in the dirt to shape an androgynous human from the dirt. God is breathing out the human's first in-breath. It's a beautiful picture, inspiration. And the human becomes, in the Hebrew, it's nefesh. It's often translated soul, but a better translation is a living being. So as I think it was Caroline who emphasized, maybe last week in Proverbs 8, Lady Wisdom, who is like the purveyor of the Proverbs in the book of Proverbs, is present at creation, playing in the world, his earth, God's earth, and delights with humankind. So if you look in the Christian Bible, the Proverbs is bookended by the Psalms on one side and by the Song of Songs on the other side, an erotic love poem. And so this is like a trilogy of the pulsing human heart. So that's divine wisdom coming to us is always in that shape. So nothing in this trilogy is abstract or philosophical or high-minded or an ideal of moral or spiritual perfection. It's really actually hard to find that in all of Scripture. Lady Wisdom, though, in particular, takes human form for us who, you know, we occupy an ecological niche between the dirt and the divine, right? Another way to put it is knowledge is knowing that the tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad. Big difference. So let's examine the saying of Lady Wisdom. This is Proverbs 25, 21, 22, using the beloved Robert Alter translation. If your foe is hungry, feed him bread. If he thirsts, give him water. For you would heap live coals on his head, and the Lord will pay you back. So biblical Hebrew, I learned recently, has a very limited vocabulary, compared to English. Biblical Hebrew contains only 8,000 distinct words. By comparison, the Oxford English Dictionary has 600,000 distinct words. So if you've only got a limited number of words to use to describe the vast, you know, experience of living in this world, then each Hebrew word has to carry a much wider range of meanings, right? And connotations. So then to think that a book written in this language with this limited vocabulary only has one correct interpretation, that's not a sensible approach. It's not doing justice to what we're dealing with. The word scripture just means writing, and writing is nothing without a reader. Every act of reading is an act of interpretation. If only in the emphasis you put it on the words, or the tone of voice you use when you speak the words, or hear the words in your head. When we read a proverb like this one, we're kind of in a relationship of co-creation with all those who used the proverb before that survived and brought it to our attention, and then from the ultimate sort of purveyor of the proverbs, which is this figure, Lady Wisdom. I like to think of it like that. Every interpretation is an act of co-creation with this living word. So if your foe is hungry, feed him bread. If he thirsts, give him water. Obviously, this informed Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. We can recognize that. And his tradition, his whole tradition, the Hebrew Bible, was concerned with what? The problem of escalating violence. In Genesis 4, the firstborn of Adam and Eve, Cain, murders his brother Abel. By the way, the first act of murder in all of Scripture was an act of religious rage. Cain was enraged by the worship of his brother, and that caused the murder. What if we centered the fall, the doctrine of the fall, in the first murder as an act of religious rage? Would that have given us some warning signs? So also in Genesis 4, Cain's great-great-grandson, Lamech, I don't know how you pronounce it, boasted to his wives, "I have slain a man for wounding me and a lad for bruising me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. It's like, wow. That's escalating violence right there, and it's occurring in the fourth chapter of the Bible. So, if we turn our nose up on an eye for an eye, like we're way beyond that, it's three times in the Torah, we're above it. But until someone actually puts your eye out, and you feel the rage of having that happen to you, well, an eye for an eye is actually, in that context, it's a significant constraint on this problem of escalating violence. It just ends with that one payback. So feeding a hungry foe, obviously, when it's called for, goes further. And when it happens, you're like, well, how would that even be possible if you've got a real foe on your hands? Well, that's what the next part of the proverb helps us. If your foe is hungry, feed him bread. If he thirsts, give him water. For you would heap live coals on his head, and the Lord will pay you back or reward you. Remember, the proverbs are situational wisdom. So they're not one size fit all situation. They're not universal anything. They're very situational. There are plenty of proverbs about avoiding and getting as far away you can from fools and from dangerous people. So sometimes that's what you need to do. But you will know the situation when it presents itself. So first, you have to have a foe for this proverb. You know, someone who has temporarily lost sight of your humanity and is, you know, like out to get you. That's a heck of an experience. It's super appropriate, natural, and human to be angry in response to implacable foe. That's a like a God-given response. It gives you the chance to like do something about it, like get out of the way or whatever. And that anger, as we all know and we've experienced this, that's often catalyzed by legitimate fear. And if you think you can distinguish between that cocktail of emotions and hatred, you probably actually haven't had a foe. It's not how our emotions work, right? And then, so first you have to have a foe. Then, and this doesn't always happen, a moment arises when your foe has some need, like is hungry or thirsty, and you have some bread. Now, I don't think the image here, I don't think it means your foe is hungry between meals. The Proverbs arose among a people who lived one bad harvest away from famine. So these are the conditions. You have a foe. Your foe is hungry or some other, you know, equivalent need. You have bread, something to meet the need, and four, it's safe, and maybe it's unavoidable to be near the foe. All the stars have to align for this proverb to kind of kick in. Now, most times, I'm thinking inside my head, an implacable foe wants desperately to exercise power over you. But when he takes that piece of bread from you, which he would not do unless he didn't have any other options, he acknowledges your power over him. And that may infuriate him. It no doubt will infuriate your foe, like live coals on the head. Hebrew didn't have, I don't think, a word for infuriate. They used all these images to convey it from simpler words. And that for you, my friend, may be a rewarding feeling when it happens. And it's nothing to be ashamed of. And that, I think, is kind of the key to understand Lady Wisdom, and also it's a key to understand the a vision of the God that's borne witness to in these writings through Lady Wisdom. That's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, I had an implacable foe making my life miserable once, well, ago, bygones. But the day came when all those stars aligned, like it happened almost like in a moment. I had the foe needed something, I had it to give, I decided to give it. And in this case, it was my blessing in the presence of some other people. Foe did not earn my blessing. But it was my blessing to give to whom I wanted, and I chose to give it to him in that moment. Did part of me know that part of him would be infuriated by the fact that he needed a blessing that only I could give? You bet. Knowing the possible live coals on the head effect actually made it easier. And I think it preserved my dignity, so to speak, in the moment, to offer the blessing. Is that something to be ashamed of? Not unless we're ashamed of our humanity. And remember, Lady Wisdom delights in our humanity, is not ashamed of it, so why should we be? So Paul, quotes this proverb in a portion of Romans that begins, bless those who persecute, Romans chapter 12, bless those who persecute you, and other things related to that. Sounds great, if you've never experienced persecution. You know, like, whoa, what a great thing, you know? I want to be the kind of person that blesses those who persecute me. You know, people who love this verse are never persecuted. You know, this is just like, that's like white Christianity kind of, you know, bless those who persecute you. You haven't seen persecution and like, you're the persecutor, get off, you know. Ugh, yeah, I want to be blessed because I like my, I hope this is true because I want all these people that I'm oppressing to turn around and thank me. Oh, I'm off on a tangent. So then the question is, you know, what do you do with all that anger if you're actually persecuted? Which, you know, I'm talking about rage. This proverb is Paul's answer to that. Sometimes when you bless those who persecute you, they may find it infuriating. He quotes this proverbs at the end of that little section, and I'm like, deal, I'm down with that. That is something I can get on that bus and go with you. So ladies, wisdom in this situation and many others has taught me not to be ashamed of my humanity because she delights in my human way of being in the world. Who do I thank for that? Who do I have to thank for that? Who do we have to thank for that? The ancestors, the ones living as defeated people at the crossroads of competing empires in the Middle East, whose scribes around 500 BCE compiled these proverbs. They're living in defeat, have been for a long time, and will continue to live in defeat for another 500 years until their nation is decimated by the Roman Empire, and then they're just scattered all around the world. It's just like these scribes, whoever they were, gathered up these writings, including these proverbs, to like buttress a defeated people who would continue to be oppressed for centuries. And those scribes imagined those proverbs as being inspired by Lady Wisdom. And then they were field tested, you know, over a long period of time. Who knows what proverbs didn't make the cut? I propose sticks and stones will break your bones and words will never hurt you. Just ditch that one. That was great for the 1950s. A bunch of white people, you know, didn't have to worry about anything. I'm sorry, I'm off on a tangent. Each of those proverbs is a potential winner of the People's Choice Awards, you know, because they're not just like divinely inspired, but they're humanly approved. And when you get that combination of wisdom, divinely inspired and humanly approved by, you know, hard-fought experience of people who are really in the trenches of life, you know you have something that's really worth trying on for size in the different situations that you're all going to face. So that's the end of that. And I think it's time to turn it over to Elle for, not Elle?
Caroline.
Caroline, okay. I give Elle my, good, this is going to be easier.